You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything. This is the Brian Callen and Joe Rogan show right now.
This is the Joe Rogan Experience / Brian Callen podcast. We decided, you know, we were going to do two different podcasts, and you do mine one day, and I'll do yours. Problem is, ladies and gentlemen, we're leaving in the morning. We haven't done anything.
Exactly. I know. We're going to do. The thing is, hunting is so
tiring.
It's exhausting. Fighting the cold and just...
It's so cold.
We basically didn't sleep for the first 2 days. We slept 4 hours.
Yeah.
Because when you go hunting...
How about 3 days?
Yeah.
What did we sleep last night? 4.5 hours?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, we slept like 4 hours a night, and you freeze your dick off all day.
I swear to God, I think I have it down to a science now, though. If you have those heat warmers...
Yes.
I put them in on my kidneys.
The heat warmers, stomach. Explain those things. There's little sticky things. What are they called?
They're like hand warmers, and there's a chemical that it sticks to your body or it sticks to your feet. Toe warmers.
The company's called Heat Factory.
Yeah, it keeps you warm.
It says, what is that? Cousins Chauffants?
Dude, if we had had those in Montana a year ago, we would have been
way better off.
Way better off.
But the experience,
I spent 5 days cold, 6 days cold. That was an accomplishment that I got through that.
But the experience wouldn't have been as good.
Right.
Bullshit. What is this? Why is it in French? What are they fucking?
Cousin Chauffant.
Queer fucking French. What is this? Thing, what is bullshit.
This, what is this French fucking heat
and pets? Chauffant. The company's called Heat Factory. And they make, I don't know what's in them, probably cancer that gives you warmth. It's probably, you sacrifice like a couple of days of your life every time you put one of these things next to your dick. And you take these little packets and you smush them.
They work.
Yeah, they work great. Dude, my feet were so fucking cold the first day, but then the second day, I put these things on my toes and then I put them on the bottom of my insoles and I was golden.
It's funny because you can buy, like, you bought those moon boots to keep
those
your feet warm.
Fucking shitbag boots.
Yeah.
Those things made me fall twice and fucked up my scope, which made me wound a deer.
Yeah, that sucked.
It sucked hard. It was very,
you guys
very
spent
depressing.
A long time tracking that deer. You did the
more
right
than
thing.
2.5 hours.
Yeah, you did the right
we
thing.
Followed a blood trail for 2.5 hours, which I don't know how long it took the deer, probably only a few minutes to run where it went. The bullet, we don't know where it hit. We'll have to look at the actual footage itself, but I shot 2 deer, and one dead perfect, and killed it instantly. It dropped where literally where it was standing, it fell over. It didn't run. I have a big rifle. It's a 300 Win Mag, which is a very powerful rifle. And one of the reasons why I got a very powerful rifle is I wanted to kill animals humanely and quickly. I thought, why would I have something like... I love the idea of bow hunting, but the problem with bow hunting is even with really experienced bow hunters,
you always
wound animals.
You wound animals, you got to track them.
Yeah.
And sometimes they can run for like, you know, 3
exactly.
hours. I mean,
you punch a hole through an animal's chest, like you hit your deer in Montana with a 300 Win Mag.
It's going down.
It's going down instantly.
Yeah.
It's a very, very powerful round. So it's one of the reasons why I got it in the first place, but unfortunately these fucking moon boots, I bought these super insulated boots that are good to like 40 below zero, but they're enormous and they're really hard to walk in. And you're walking on like these snow-covered logs and shit. You're walking uphill. And I slipped and I fell twice.
Right.
And my rifle hit the ground and it fucked the scope up. It fucked up my sight. And I didn't know it would fuck the scope up.
It's a good thing that you practiced. Well,
it's a good thing that I wanted to judge because I almost shot at another animal
right.
the next day. But I talked to Steve Rinell and I said, hey man, if I knock the scope, like, would it throw it off? He goes, nah, man, you'd have to bang that fucker off a rock. Well, it turns out.
You banged it off a rock.
Well, I hit the ground pretty hard, but also when the guy from Vortex installed it, like, it could have been a little tighter. And I don't want to blame it on him. He didn't know I was going to be falling. You know, I'm a fucking idiot. I had bad boots. I fell. But ultimately, what paid the price was both the deer and my remorse.
What was different about this trip for you than the first time you went hunting?
Well, first of all, the sitting. The first time we went, it was fucking freezing. But freezing is not nearly as bad when you're walking.
Yeah.
Because you actually generate a sweat. Like, when we were walking around in Montana, it was probably lower temperatures. It was like 9 degrees at the most, you know, when we were walking around. I mean, how cold did it get? It got really fucking cold when we were walking around. It got a little colder out here. It got to zero. But you're sitting. You're sitting. Today was great. Today was like 25.
It's funny, too, because yesterday was -3 at one point, and today was 25, and it felt like we were at the beach.
Yeah. And, you know, the difference is, even -3, though, there was no wind.
Yeah.
There's a difference. The first day, it was like... The first day was like 13 degrees and fucking blistering wind, and it was brutal. But the big difference is the big difference between hunting for whitetails, which is what we did this trip, and hunting for mule deer, which is what we did last year, is mule deer, you're hiking.
Yeah.
You're going up big hills.
It's crazy how much ground
you get
we
exhausted.
Covered.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Dude, the first day, Ranella and I walked for 7 hours.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's
exhausted.
Nuts. You're exhausted.
And lucky you and I are in shape.
Yeah, there's no way I could have done that if I hadn't been in shape. There's
no
way.
Impossible.
Packing that meat out?
Yeah.
That was nuts.
Well, remember when he was talking about how he took these guys on a trip? And, you know, he said, well, these guys in shape? Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, like, these guys are in the ultimate shape.
Oh, yeah.
But meanwhile, they were like power lifters.
Yeah, they show up with these huge necks and these massive thighs. 45 minutes later, the guy's throwing up, literally throwing up on the trail.
Falling apart on him. And Ranella is, Steve Ranella is the guy who's the host of Meat Eater. He's the guy who took us hunting. He's been on my podcast. Has he been on your podcast yet?
No, not yet.
You need to get him
on. I got
to
get him on. He's so smart. He's so knowledgeable in such an like authentic way.
But he's in really deceptively good shape when it comes to hunting. He's in amazing hunting shape. I mean, the guy could just fucking walk forever. I mean, he just gets up and goes at 4:30 in the morning, and he's walking all fucking day. And you follow him up hills, and you're just like heaving, breathing heavy. And you and I, obviously, are when it comes to like the average person, we're in much better shape than the average person. But if you're one of those fucking people that doesn't work out at all,
there's no way.
It's too hard.
But that's why most hunting is done the way we did it
today.
Sitting. With a cabin, with a warm cabin. I'd say much more comfortable when you can take a shower and sleep in a house on a bed. That's unbelievable.
The first time we went camping, when we went in Montana, I hadn't been camping since I was like 8.
Oh, okay. An outdoorsman, I'm not, dude.
We're wearing all of our clothes in a sleeping bag.
Two sleeping bags and freezing my balls off.
Shivering our teeth.
Yeah, until Ryan Callahan said, take a thermos. Fill it with hot water, put it at the bottom of your sleeping bag. Yeah. Changed my life.
It does help.
Yeah.
Still sucks.
It's
the four seasons.
You can keep it.
It sucks.
You can fucking keep it.
Sucking a fat dick.
But
now
I kind of have this.
It's quick.
But now I have this. It's funny. It's weird. I now have this urge to do alpine, to go high up in the mountains and hunt goat and stuff.
Because Steve was talking about it.
Meanwhile, I know I'll be miserable. I said, what do you eat? He goes, well, morning we eat oatmeal, and during the day we eat salami and cheese on crackers, and then at night we eat freeze-dried food and candy. And I go, really? He goes, yeah, it works.
We're doing a podcast. Have at it.
It's good stuff.
Mike Hutch from Florida.
Yeah, we had good people. Mike leases like 900 acres, and he's got and he killed 400 hogs on his property last year.
What do you got there, brother?
Did you guys sign that for Doug for something?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, we're supposed to.
We would love to do that, but we're in the middle of a fucking podcast that 1 million people are going to listen to.
Exactly.
Son of a bitch.
8 million.
We're here with a bunch of great guys. That was one thing about this trip that was really cool is that Doug Duren, who owns this farm, and it's this huge farm in Wisconsin, has a bunch of friends that came down, and they're staying here for the week while we're at opening day and the first week of hunting season, and just a bunch of great guys. We didn't even know them until we got here. All we knew is the crew of Meat Eater. Yeah. We only knew Dan and Steve Ranella.
Right, but you know what Dan I thought Doty. About with all that is that I was thinking about how what we did. If you look at the bulk of human history, this is what men did year round every single day just to live. Like,
yeah, but they didn't have scopes.
No, that's what I mean. But what I thought about was this: is that
they didn't have
you delineate. You had to work as a team. You had to work as a team because you imagine trying to catch a deer without guns. You'd have to be very organized. You got to delineate authority, and you got to speak without speaking. That's why they say that men speak less. Like unless there's something to talk about. Like we've evolved to kind of like you know how like when men get in a group, like they delineate quickly. Like people find their place in sort of the in the structure. They structure themselves automatically.
And when they don't, it stands out like a sore thumb.
Yes.
If a guy who values himself more highly than the group values himself, it becomes very uncomfortable.
Yeah, he gets fucking pushed out or threatened pretty
quickly.
Yeah,
and people will complain about that, but that there's a reality to the water level. There's a watermark.
That's right. That's right.
You're not reaching that watermark. And all you're complaining and pretending and, you know, you guys are being an asshole to Tim. No, Tim is an annoying douchebag who has nothing interesting
and
to
he's
say.
And he's making noise and mm-hmm. we're not going to get fed.
Exactly. That's why we push Tim in the corner.
That's right. You Tim, stay home.
Tim needs to wash dishes and shut the fuck up.
Tend to the fire. Tend
if
to the
you
fire,
want to
Tim.
Stay alive. Tim will collect wood.
I'm going to throw you in a flying headlock.
I'm going to fucking eat Tim if shit gets rough.
Yeah, that's probably what happened. You know what? He's a loudmouth. Do you guys just want to eat him and not fucking go hunting today?
There's a reality to life. And by the way, there's a lot of people who are like Tim, and those are the ones who rally for Tim. They're like, Tim's a good guy. You guys are dicks. No. Tim's a loser.
Yeah.
And you're a loser too.
Yeah. And you're looking tasty too now.
Exactly, you fuck. What you're doing is you're identifying with Tim and you think we're being shitheads. We're not being shitheads. What we're doing is being natural.
Yeah.
There's a nature. There's nature.
Yeah.
And the funny people make you laugh. The sad people make you cry. And that's how it's always been. And
that's right.
The annoying people make you want to stab them. That guy's an annoying cunt, you know, and he can't fucking find deer and he's always mooching.
I thought it would be easier in some ways, like sitting in a blind in that cold is a lesson in endurance.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think we sat today for 4 hours straight without really moving much.
Yeah.
And I haven't done that. I was thinking about that. I didn't look at my phone. I haven't done that in a long time. There's a meditative state like you get into. Like I was, when you're actively looking for something, when you're actively looking at a large area and looking for any movement and checking with your scope and checking with your binocs, that's a very interesting state to be in because it's a very active thing without being active. Like it's something I haven't done a lot of.
It's also weird because there's these periods of intense waiting followed by
excitement.
Intense excitement.
Yeah.
There's like nothing for hours. And then all of a sudden, oh my God, it's a fucking deer. He's right there.
Yeah.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
He's coming close. You got it.
You just zero in.
You got the shot. Stay calm. I remember Ryan Callahan in the first episode of Meat Eater saying to you, calm.
Yeah.
Calm.
Yeah.
And then ba-boom.
Well, because the first buck I had on my sight, I got buck fever.
Yeah.
I'm telling you right now, the scope was bouncing all over the place.
Nerves are crazy.
Man.
They don't serve you totally. You have to learn how to get them to serve you.
Well, because when you're drawing a bead on an animal that's 200 yards away, that's precise. You've got to be, mainly because I don't want to shoot something and wound it.
Right.
So mainly you're aiming right behind the shoulder and you want to drop it right away. But when the farther out it is, the more precarious that shot becomes because a tiny little movement of your leg or a tiny movement will can change everything.
Yeah.
You can miss or you can wound it or, you know.
It's also how you're holding the gun. Like, what are you resting on? How stable is it? Like, you know the classic photo of a guy standing there holding the rifle in your hand?
Doesn't exist.
The rifle butt against your shoulder. That's the last thing you want to do if you're shooting at something.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes that's all you have. Like, sometimes, like, you're walking and the animal runs in front of you.
Yeah.
And you have to take a shot.
Or a lion's charging you or something.
But that's not an accurate shot.
Yeah.
Like, you want to rest on something. And you want to really draw a bead on something. And then once you get it in and you stay calm, don't flinch, squeeze,
yeah,
and the shot goes off. And that's a hard thing to learn how to do.
It's also amazing how violent and powerful those hunting rifles are.
Yeah.
Like a .30-06 or your Win Mag 300 or even my .270, man. That's a powerful, powerful weapon. When you see what it does to a 165-pound animal,
yeah,
or, you know, plus.
It punches a hole through space and time.
Goes right through it.
goes
and drops
right
it.
Their body.
Yeah, and then you open the animal up, and you see what ballistics do. You can see what that kind of velocity, because what a bullet like that does, I believe, I've talked to some people like cops and stuff, is that with that kind of velocity, it displaces all the organs that come around it so violently and so quickly. Like it creates this huge cavity, this hole, so blood comes out of both ends, and then it comes back together. And the shock is what kills you a lot of times. It's crazy.
Yeah, this gun that I shot was much more powerful than the gun that I shot my first deer with. This gun punched a hole straight through the deer.
Yeah.
Both sides. Yeah. Yeah, it punched a hole through the both ribs and just right out the other end. And
that Win Mag is no fucking joke.
Oh.
Meanwhile, Steve Ranella was telling us that if you hunt with an AR-15, the round is a 223. It's a shitty deer rifle because it's really, a lot of times it just wounds the animal, or it's just not as effective unless you're a really good shot. You got
to
be really
precise.
Or
unless you turn it to fully automatic. Like,
there is that.
You hit the deer 80 times, then you have to pull lead out of your food.
There is that.
Mike's in the other room laughing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a good... Not a good weapon.
No.
For deer.
Well, it was designed to actually wound a soldier so that you slow the whole platoon down. Do you know that?
Really?
Yeah. So an M16 and stuff, it was designed so that it's not a huge round, but what it'll do is it'll hit somebody, and a lot of times it'll wound the enemy. And what that means is two guys got to come out, get
him, carry him,
and everybody, and it slows the whole thing down. Then you start taking those guys out. So that's what I believe the assault rifle was sort of designed for, especially the M16. It's pretty wild.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
They went with a smaller round on purpose.
Yeah.
Did you read this, or is it just like
I've read that, and I've heard that, and I heard that from Tyson downstairs, who was in the Army, who told me that, and he owns an AR-15, and he said that's why they use. I mean, first of all, it's a very effective killing weapon too, though. But a lot of times it'll take a little longer. It's not a devastating, you know. And also, you want a more accurate gun that doesn't recoil as much and stuff like that when you're in combat. But, you know, when I was talking to, this sounds really kind of morbid, but Steve Ranella was talking about how in Afghanistan they put a bunch of cameras up to look for snow leopards and, you know, on trails to see what that war had done to the wildlife. And these Green Berets were... on this trail, and I guess they had wounded this enemy combatant, and he got pulled in to the behind a tree, and they were waiting to see if anybody was going to reach for that rifle, and he was watching it on his night scope, and a snow leopard came in, licked the blood, and then kind of went away.
Yeah.
But I thought to myself, I was like, I guess what if you were a special forces sniper. And I've heard that Sam Sheridan told me that they actually train snipers by hunting elk. It's the same skill set, tracking, climbing, finding it, being not being seen. Like elk can smell you from a mile away.
Yeah.
And it's pretty wild, but
it totally makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense.
If you're stalking an animal. I mean, their senses are much more heightened than a person's.
Doesn't it give you... I've said this before on a podcast, maybe yours, but, I mean, when you see what that knife can do to flesh, it really gives you respect for the...
Well, we're very vulnerable.
We're like pin cushions, dude.
Yeah, we're less than that. We're like...
But we all walk around like tough, like some. You know, you lift weights, do jujitsu, and you train. You're like, you feel kind of strong and not
vulnerable. Yeah, we're real tough with people.
Yeah, until somebody pulls out like a killer pulls out a blade and knows how to use one.
That's nothing compared to a bullet. You could survive a cut. Think about one of those 300 Win Mags hitting your chest and annihilating your heart and spinal cord.
Yeah.
It just blows a hole through that no surgeon can fucking put back.
Forget it. Sam Sheridan told me that I think he said something like, if you get shot with a handgun. 80% of the people survive. If you get shot with a rifle, 20% of the people survive, typically, because of the velocity of a rifle.
Totally makes sense.
Good luck.
It depends on what kind of rifle. How about one of those motherfuckers they use to hunt elephants and hippos and shit?
Yeah, the 375s. I've shot one of those things, an elk gun.
Boom. Yeah, it's weird to get used to that, isn't it? That's the feeling of shooting something.
Yeah.
Just the feeling of shooting a gun.
It as weird as it is, it also feels natural after a while in a weird way.
I found out that my rifle was off because I came back to Doug. Doug has a at his farm has actually a shooting range in his yard, and I went out there and I asked him. I shot a couple shots that I knew were dead on because you know he has a bench, so he can sit the gun down. There's no you don't have to worry about holding it and the movement of your arm. You can keep it dead straight. And I knew I was hitting it dead center, and it wasn't hitting dead center. So he came over, and I said, will you please do this for me? He, like, shoot a couple shots. Tell me. And he was hitting the exact spot that I was hitting. So I was like, okay, clearly there's something wrong here. And then the only thing that made sense was that I dropped the scope. I mean, that I dropped the whole rifle, but the scope got rattled. And then he adjusted it. And when he adjusted it, we got it down to absolutely perfect. But that just, that. Boom.
What do you think you in its essence like about hunting? Like you're really into it. Like you bought a rifle. What do you think?
I love it.
Do you think you'll do it now for the rest of your life?
Yeah. It's fun. I mean, it sounds terrible to say that it's fun to kill something. But
that's a small part of hunting.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
It's very spiritual, man. There's a connection between an animal that you shoot and eat. And that sounds like horseshit. It really does. It sounds like horseshit to me, so I'm going to call myself out on it if I was ignorant, but I can't not say that. I can't. Like, sometimes you say, look, this is going to sound corny, but this is what it is. Because sometimes the truth sounds corny.
Yeah.
And the reality of hunting is that it's a spiritual thing. You're out there with an animal, and the first time we went hunting, like, the when we were in Montana, I shot that buck. It was very psychedelic. And what I mean by psychedelic was like there was this weird connection that I had with this animal. It's you're watching this thing move and it's in its natural habitat and it doesn't even know what the fuck you are. Mm-hmm. We were in the Badlands of Montana, which is the Missouri River breaks,
Missouri Breaks,
which is an area that's very difficult to get to and very few human beings go through.
Nobody ever actually lived there. They even say the Blackfeet Indian used to use it as a hunting ground, but they never lived there because you couldn't grow anything.
Well, some Americans,
the homesteaders,
quote unquote, they tried to homestead there, but you can't grow anything.
No.
So they all died off or they quit. And there's a bunch of houses actually that Brian and I found that were they just laying around, these old houses from like the 1800s. It's really
surreal,
weird, ominous, really ominous. But there was something psychedelic about the connection that I had with this animal, this weird thing that's looking at me, and then I punch a fucking hole through its body and it dies. And then we're eating it. And I'm like, this is very strange. It's not what I thought it was going to be. And being that, like, the remorse of killing the animal was almost non-existent. And maybe that was because that I had rationalized.
Or you worked for it, though.
I mean, maybe, but still. I still took a life. Like, I should feel some sort of remorse. I felt very emotional and very connected to it, but I didn't feel any remorse. And that was kind of surprising.
Mm.
And even though I wounded the buck that I hit, it was a long-distance shot, the first buck in Montana. It was like 200 yards. And I shot it through the upper back, and it was hurt badly. It would have died for sure, but we were using copper bullets because copper bullets are better for the environment. When you use lead bullets, which is very traditional, lead bullets spread out and they cause a much bigger exit wound, and it kills much more easily because of the exit wound.
Oh, because it's a softer metal.
Exactly.
So it peels.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Whereas copper just basically is a pencil hole. Copper punches right through it like a pencil hole. And Steve started using copper because...
And it's contentious among, like, hunters. I mean, it's so interesting how tribal it becomes.
Yeah, they don't want to use it because they've been using lead their whole life. And because it doesn't have as much... when you have the exit wound, doesn't spread like lead does. But, like, then there was, like, with ducks and shit like that. Like, they use steel pellets over lead.
Lead, yeah.
Because lead is like bad for the environment.
Well, when you have five generations of hunters using lead over the same pond, year after year, the lead concentration can tend, you know, the worry is that it actually becomes an environmental hazard. I don't know if I want to eat duck or fish in a pond that's taking on that much lead.
Yeah, but it's not just that. It's also that the ducks themselves actually take the lead and put it in their gizzard.
That's right.
They think it's like gravel.
That's
like
right.
What they always do. That's how they part of the way they dissolve their food or digest their food is they have a gizzard, and their gizzard has rocks in it. And they think that these lead pellets are actually rocks. So they're taking lead into their body. They're eating lead. It's poisonous.
We ate beaver today.
Yeah,
just
we ate a little beaver. It was actually delicious.
Yeah, it was but delicious.
The copper bullet punched a hole right through the deer but didn't totally kill it. So I had to come up to it and essentially execute it. And shoot it through the heart after it was down. And I thought I would feel a sense of remorse, but instead I felt a sense of awe and appreciation and also this weird connection. It was like very spiritual. And again, I hate that fucking word because it's overused. It's used by charlatans and yoga teachers that want to fuck their students. You know, it's very spiritual. I'm not religious, but I'm very spiritual. But it really was spiritual in some sort of strange way. That I never understood before I did it.
And well, you know what I learned about hunting, if so any of you guys, that according to Steve Rinella, there are more deer today than there were when, if in the 1400s.
I told
in,
you that.
Yeah. And why?
Was it Steve Rinella?
Was that you?
It was me.
Yeah, because of agriculture, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because of agriculture and also because of land management and the reduction of predators.
Yeah, yeah. And so deer love, they can eat corn, they can eat alfalfa and all the things that we grow.
Especially white-tailed deer, because white-tailed deer, like we were hunting here, they thrive in farm environments because they have these machines on Doug's farm that take the ears of corn and they chew the kernels off and leave the cobs behind with like a few kernels on them. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that deers feed on. They come by and they find the shucked kernels and they'll chew away the bottom parts.
Right.
That didn't get removed by the machine. And it's, you know, it's healthy food. It's like free food. It's corn. They eat the corn.
Yep.
They also eat alfalfa. They have plots that they grow out here for the deer specifically. Food. They call them food plots.
Hmm.
They actually grow food to make the deer healthy. And Mike, who was just laughing in the other room, was telling us about his land that he leases in Florida where they're adding soybeans to the food that they feed their deers, so that these deers will have much larger racks because of the protein in soybeans.
Right.
So there's like a management aspect to taking care of these deer that, you know, a lot of people don't understand when they talk about hunting and hunting being bad. More conservation money is donated by hunters than any other
group.
By far.
Yeah.
More effort is put to conserving species, protecting them from not just predation by other animals, but protecting their environment,
mm-hmm.
you know, predation from people, like controlling the seasons in which you're allowed to shoot these animals. Yeah, Rinella and I were having an interesting conversation about how in the early 1900s was when they first started putting hunting limits. And before they started putting hunting limits, they had like almost eradicated like many, many species, like elk in Arizona, gone.
Yep.
You know, they had to like reintroduce these species.
That proves that when you got to have some laws, man. People will they will literally decimate.
But the beautiful thing about the laws, when it comes to wildlife, it's one of the very few things that's actually governed by the people who love the wildlife itself.
Yeah.
Governed by the people who enjoy hunting, enjoy fishing. They regulate the amount of numbers. Like, you're allowed to catch X amount of fish. You're allowed to shoot X amount of turkeys. And they do this all based on the statistics of the actual numbers of the animals that are alive. And they maintain healthy populations, including what they're doing right now while you and I are in here in Wisconsin. They have a real problem. They have too many fucking deer. And they're trying to eliminate these deer because we were talking to some of the guys, are like Doug's brother Dave, was telling us about certain areas where you drive to, like around Kentucky, where the roads are just littered with carcasses because people are slamming into them with their cars because it's essentially an infestation of deer. And there's only one way to deal with that. You got to bring in hunters.
Mm.
You got to bring in hunters. And they're all food, by the way. They're free food.
I'm sorry, but that deer we had today, that you fried up, has got to be the best meat I've ever had.
Fantastic.
It's better than elk.
It's what's so fresh.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's like you just got to know how to cook it. And, you know, I read a lot about cooking, like, raw game. And for, you see how quick I cooked those
things? Yeah, it was crazy.
30 seconds.
Put it on a high flame. Throw some butter in a pan.
Hot skillet on full blast.
Garlic.
Garlic, butter,
salt.
Pepper. 30 seconds each side. Done.
Done.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's so good for you.
It's the craziest thing I've ever eaten.
It tastes so good.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's better than anything else. And they manage it. They manage this animal.
Yep.
So, you know, instead of it slamming into cars, you know, hunters are allowed to take them home. They freeze them. And you got to keep healthy populations alive. And one of the ways to keep healthy populations alive, you got to break it down to a manageable number. There's this population, this amount of farms, this amount of food, this amount of people can only support X amount of deer.
Mm-hmm.
And these people that run these wildlife management companies or the wildlife management organizations, the various state regulatory bodies, they do a fantastic job.
Yeah, they really do.
Because it's all run by hunters.
Well, as a result, you know, the animals like mountain lions and black bears are not endangered.
Yeah.
The biggest problem is habitat loss. That's the problem with the bobcat. And that's the problem with grizzly bears and stuff. They wander huge areas. So animals that have very specific needs that are not adaptable, those are the ones that, you know, have issues. But
and those are the ones I'm least sympathetic to. Grizzly bears. Fuck bobcats.
I love grizzly bears.
They can all suck my dick. A mountain lion ate my dog when I lived in Colorado.
Listen, mountain lions rule.
They can suck it. If I could get a bead on one from my living room, I'd blow his fucking brains out and then put my gun inside, shut the window, and go back to watching TV.
Hey, man.
They can suck it.
I like mountain lions.
I hate them.
We should tell the people that you named your gun.
Doris.
Doris.
I don't know why.
Well, I think it's an outstanding name. And I'm very happy with the way she performed. She was a little temperamental. She didn't like getting knocked around.
That was my fault.
And now she's...
That wasn't even Doris. That was Scope.
Well, that's... What do you... Do you have a name for your Scope?
Clyde. Doris and Clyde.
Really? It's funny how I guess you do have to have... You can't... Clyde can't be part of Doris. Your Scope has got to be separate, huh?
And it can't be a lesbian relationship. It has to be a man and a woman.
So Doris and Clyde.
Yeah, Clyde's a man.
Huh.
The Scope's a man.
All right.
Scope.
Clyde and Doris.
If it wasn't for Doris, Clyde would be a loser.
You love
and
your
if it
gear.
Wasn't for Clyde, Doris wouldn't be able to see where the fuck she's going.
I want to hunt. Hey, can we hunt where it's warm one time, please?
Well, the next time we hunt with Steve, we're going to hunt for wild boar.
So I don't have to bring that much gear. I brought two suitcases.
We're going to hunt for wild pigs in California.
Well, I love pigs, so.
Wasn't it interesting what he was telling us about pigs, that they're all the same? That wild boar and pigs are essentially the same animal?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That is wild.
Well, he knows... He knows too much. It's ridiculous. I mean, everything about Native Americans, everything about like animal behavior, it's crazy. The details. Like he was talking about how you'll find moose horns together, and you won't find like that with deer necessarily, because when a moose loses one horn, he's like, whoa, his head gets weighted to the other side, and he's got
they're like 30 pounds or
something. Yeah, he's got to fucking get that one off too. And they shed their horns. So they shed entire racks.
Yep.
Like it just comes off.
Yeah, every animal does that's that has antlers, except I think pronghorn sheep.
Oh, yeah?
I think pronghorn antelope, rather. Hmm. I think pronghorn antelope don't shed.
Strange.
Yeah, they got a weird antelope. Antelopes have weird horns, weird antlers.
Yeah.
They're like similar to deer, but not quite deer. There's so many variables when it comes to those weird, like elk is like in the deer family, but it's not a deer. You know, it's in the deer family, and then there's whitetails. And then he was telling me that whitetails, which were predominantly on the East Coast and in the Midwest, they morphed, and like what mule deers are and what blacktails are is some sort of a combination of different deers.
Mm.
And the whitetails...
I don't give a shit. They all taste fucking really, really good. That's all I have to say.
Whitetails are supposed to be the most delicious.
We're picking this podcast back up, and we're in the car now with Steve Ranella driving to the airport. And so... that's the transition here.
Yeah, we decided last night to just go to bed. We did it for 20 minutes, and we were kind of being rude. Everybody was sleeping. Hey, Brian, can you hand me my water right there?
Yeah.
You guys Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, we're making a podcast.
I think we're going to start. I want to start with Steve Ranella, who was telling a story about his brother, who's an amazing character. And I want to hear Steve Ranella, who's a master hunter, talk about the first time his brother shot a deer in front of his wife. And and his wife, who doesn't hunt, probably eats more game meat than any woman in New York City and maybe in the country. And yet she doesn't really like to hunt, but she's always munching on bear, squirrel, beaver, deer, elk, etc. So, and she's squeamish, Steve, about, like, you know, killing animals.
No, she like my wife likes to fish. I grew up in Michigan. My wife grew up in Michigan as well, and we never knew each other. We met later, and her version of growing up in Michigan was a lot different than mine. When we were only 2 hours apart, so she didn't grow up around hunting at all. She always said she had one friend that liked to hunt. So when we started going out, she was a little apprehensive about the hunting situation. And my brothers and I, along with a buddy, owned this place in Southeast Alaska on an island called Prince Wales Island. And my brother Danny got married up there a few years ago. And a couple days after he got married, I went up the mountain one morning and killed a black-tailed deer. And hiked it back down to the cabin, and my brother Danny said, well, while I'm here, I'd like to go get a deer as well. And I kept trying to talk my wife into coming out with me, and she'd never been. I'd taken her out in the woods hunting, but we'd never had a successful hunt together. So she said, I don't need to go, I don't need to see that, you know, I love eating the deer, I love eating wild game, but I just, like, I'm comfortable being a hypocrite about, you know, eating it but not wanting to watch it die. So I explained to her, we'll go out, and because you don't have a developed game eye like Danny and I do, you'll never even see the deer. The deer will be off, obscured by brush, a couple hundred yards away. You won't even know it's there. He'll shoot, we'll walk up, it'll be laying there, and it's not going to be like you're not going to see a lot of graphic detail. So we take our skiff out, and the tide was out at the time. So we landed our skiff at a dry creek mouth where a bunch of salmon were pooled around waiting to go up the river when the thing flooded on the high tide. And we beach our skiff there and start hiking up the stream channel. And here comes these deer, like here comes three black-tailed deer, two does and what turned out to be a little buck, just hauling ass down the creek bed toward us. Something must have been chasing them or scared them, like a wolf or I don't know what, but they were freaked out, coming our way. And these deer keep coming and coming and coming and coming and coming till they're right in front of us. And I could see this deer's eyelashes. It's just like I could have grabbed the deer before they finally see us. And we're kind of hunkered in these rocks before they see us and stop. And I'm thinking, surely there's no way my brother would ever dare to shoot this deer this close to my wife. And I look over to the side. He's off to the left of me. I kind of look at him off the corner of my eyes, and I can see him, like, slowly snaking that rifle up, you know, up to his shoulder. And bam, you know, this deer just turns. And at first she thinks he missed it because it spun so fast, but it piles up. And she just turns on the waterworks, man, just starts crying. And I honestly thought, We got the deer, and she thinks we don't do it. She thinks we kind of like unceremoniously drag the deer back to the skiff and throw it into the skiff. Still crying.
How would you ceremoniously drag a deer back?
Like you'd build like a thing that the Incan gods rode around on and have like carry it and lay them up there real nice. I don't know. I guess she claims that the deer's head was bumping the rocks as we were dragging it along, and she thought that was uncouth. So she's crying. It was so bad. I'm not lying. It was so bad. I thought we had crossed, like, I thought that a rift had formed between us that was unmendable. It was like, she looked at me like I did. She looked at me as though she came home and I was in bed with several other women.
Several.
It was like she looked at me like,
and a
this
guy
cannot be remedied, you know. And she kind of like all of a sudden pulled it together to the it had such an effect on her. She pulled it together about 45 minutes later, and actually, and I shouldn't even say this because I don't think you're not really supposed to do this, but she later that day actually pegged a pink salmon with a rock that was coming up through a riffle and stunned the pink salmon and ran out and grabbed it. So in that same day, she actually got a fish. But it was like a thing, and from then, from that day forward, she was comfortable, I guess, with the brutality of hunting, the seeming brutality of hunting, and that was it.
Well, you started using, we were talking about this, you started using the word violence to describe hunting, where, you know, a lot of people maybe avoided that for a while.
Yeah, because there's all these words, harvest,
yeah,
took.
Right.
You know. And I kind of make a point that, you know, at least every third time I use a you know, a simile or a euphemism, I'll be like, yeah, you know, I killed a deer.
Right.
I killed a deer in a violent act, you know.
Will you explain, because we were talking a little bit about how there are more deer now than there ever were, but when when people say to you, you know, you get confronted by people who are, whether they're animal rights activists or people who are very anti-hunting, and I know that you respect that position. You've actually, one of the things that surprises me is that you're very, very tolerant of those kinds of positions, and you understand where people are coming from. But explain to me, you said the other day, you said a lot of those people don't really understand not only the deer and their habitat and why hunting is actually beneficial to animals. Can you give us some examples of why hunting an
animal? Wait, were you turning this into an interview, man? This is a fucking conversation.
Yeah, it's true. I know, but I'm just holding the mic, so that's why. But I mean, that's not an interview. I just wanted to ask him, like,
can you tell us why?
Can you tell us why, please, Steve Rinella? Please, Steve, tell us why.
It's like I don't want to bore all your listeners with such a long answer, but I'll just say, try it briefly. Wildlife is managed on the state level, and the way that wildlife management agencies get their funding to do research, enforcement, habitat improvement is through license sales and then through excise taxes on sporting goods equipment. Like, hunters bankroll American wildlife. You could be like, you go talk to a PETA guy, you'll never find a PETA dude who actually went out, or like, PETA doesn't actually go out and buy chunks of crucial habitat like wetlands, wintering grounds, whatever. They're not going out and like buying this land and protecting it, you know. And that really is what animals need. They need, like, habitat is key, places to live are key. You can remove individual animals as long as you leave the structure in place for animals to exist. And hunters have the motivation and the means, the financial means, to make sure that those things continue to happen. If you were to end hunting, I think that it would be, the end of hunting would be catastrophic for American wildlife, because so much of the funding that supports it and protects it would vanish.
Because it comes from tags.
Comes from excise taxes on sporting goods equipment, excise taxes on firearms, and all tag and license fees. Most state fish and game agencies don't have dedicated funding from the state. They're self-sufficient. Like, their money comes from license sales, and they do enforcement and research. So when you got some disease wiping stuff out and some guy goes out to find out what's going on with the disease and how it's passing along, that guy's funded by.
Yeah, I was just saying this. I wish people could see this town. This town is like this. I have a fantasy of living in a little town like this where I know everybody, but then I'd go crazy. Dude, I'd go crazy. as cute as a town is, whenever I drive through, I'm like, maybe I'll just come and move here. Yeah, right.
This is our turn.
My navigation is saying we just keep going for
5.8 miles.
Yeah.
There's a Hallmark store.
Yeah, there's Peggy's Boutique, and there's like Gavin Brothers.
Badger Theater.
It's pretty cool.
Like, yeah, it's there's something cute about small towns, but ultimately there's just not enough stuff going on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's nice to have a place to get away. That's a small town. To actually live here, this seems like it would be rough.
The key to living, like, I've lived in a lot of small towns. One of the keys to living in small towns is just, like, avoid the temptation to hang out at the bars too much. Because you enter such a different, like, when you're young and you live in small towns, like, hanging out in the bars, man, just leads to disaster. Like, you need to be a little bit, a little bit careful about getting into situations where people are riled up, mad at you. I lived in Thermopolis, Wyoming for a while, and like, as an outsider in Thermopolis, Wyoming, I used to go home we'd go. Me and my old girlfriend would go out drinking with the oil guys from the oil fields, and I'd get so unnerved with these guys, and they were so like pretty hostile. Like they didn't know why I was around, didn't understand what I did for a living, didn't like a writer. What are you doing here? They thought I was a narc, like sent to town because I was always curious about meth. And I would ask questions about like meth, and they'd get like so nervous, and they'd be so, and I'd be like, "So how does the meth thing work?" And I'm like, just this dude who showed up in town one day acting like I'm a writer, and they had to think I was like a, you know, what do you call him, like an undercover guy, you know? I would go home and load my handgun and lay it on the nightstand next to my bed because I was so convinced that these guys were going to come in and like, and torture me or something. Remember that movie Rush? I felt like that dude in Rush.
I was in Cody, Wyoming one time, and my buddy, we wanted to stay at this hotel, like a little motel. It was me, Patty, my friend that Joe knows, and my buddy Tony and his wife, and she had a newborn. And so Tony, who was a fighter, a real rough guy, he said to the guy, we wanted to stay there. It's four in one room. And he goes, no, I can't let you do that. So Tony goes, I kiss my ass and leaves. The guy followed us. And when we got to this next place, he got out of his truck. And the next thing we know, he had made a phone call to his buddies. These trucks pull up. And now we're like all, like three, four, five cowboys get out. And it's me and my buddy. And my buddy who's ready to fight anybody, basically says, bring it. Let's go right now. And I was like, oh, well, here goes. We're about to get stomped by these, like, you know, six cowboys. And it really got tense. They surrounded us. Because he had said, kiss my ass. And the next thing you know, a cop pulls up. Cop gets out and goes, listen, this is Cody, Wyoming. People do things very differently around here. You guys get out of here now, and I'll hold them off for a while. And that's literally what he said to us. And my buddy, I had to drag my buddy back in the car because my buddy was telling him he was going to give him a Maryland ass whooping, which is a weird threat. Maryland, I'll give you a Maryland ass whooping. And then he said he was going to come back with a ball bat. He goes, I'm coming back with a ball bat. I know you. I'll remember your face, and I know where your hotel is. I'm coming back with a ball bat, you son of a bitch, and I'm going to give you a Maryland ass whooping, and the rest of you guys better not be around. He's saying that out the car. That's how tough my buddy was. Just a nut.
That's not tough. That's stupid.
I would agree. I would agree, sir.
There's a lot of dummies that get themselves in trouble because of their ego, and that's exactly what that is.
Yeah.
Why would you bother?
Well,
you guys didn't grow up in big towns, did you?
No. Well, I grew up in Newton Upper Falls, which is a pretty small suburb of Boston.
Yeah, like I grew up in a town that wasn't even a town. I mean, it was like they had like a gas station. I mean, it was like a kind of an area, you know?
Right.
Like a gas station, a bar.
I have nothing to add because for me it's like I grew up overseas. I lived in Athens. I lived in Bombay and Karachi, Pakistan.
Yeah, you had the weirdest childhood ever.
Ever. I'd be moved every year and a half.
What did your parents do?
My dad was a
quote-unquote banker.
Yeah, worked for...
In quotes.
Yeah.
Did some shit for the government.
My dad did some stuff for the government. Don't you? You just keep waking up free every morning and he'll do what he does. How's that sound, Steve?
Your dad was an operative.
Easy. Allegedly. Throwing those words around on the podcast
over here.
You got to school this guy, Joe.
Yeah. What are we going to do?
Well,
this was a fucking hell of a trip, man. I had a great time, Steve. Again, thank you very much for bringing us out here. Thanks for tolerating our silliness. And, you know, last night especially with the 15-year-old kid hanging around and we're telling crazy stories about ex-girlfriends.
Yeah, you know, here's the funny thing, though. Tell them stories about, like, to a 15-year-old. We all, like, parents lose sight of what 15-year-olds know.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not embarrassed for the 15-year-old. I'm embarrassed for the dad thinking that the 15-year-old is now finding out about a lot of stuff that this kid probably has raunchier stories than anything we could spin, and fresher ones.
Well, you know,
he can still smell it on his fingers, man. You know what I mean?
Dude, I mean, first of all, it was a baptism by fire. Joe literally starts just telling unedited, 100% just true stories about, like, past, like, he's telling stories about my past girlfriends and crazy stories about when we were really young. And this kid took it all in stride.
He's got the internet. That's what I said to his dad. I was like, look, kids have the internet today.
Dude,
you gotta face that.
My buddy is a cop, and his son is 15. And he went, he literally has this whole NSA program. He goes on his kid's Facebook, and he just tries to make sure his kid's doing things that are safe. He comes across a picture on his Facebook where his 15-year-old son is making out with two girls, like taking turns making out with two girls. And the guy's like, my son's 15. He's had a threesome. I've never had a threesome. He felt like Darth Vader had been, like, trumped by Luke Skywalker. He was like, this is bullshit, man. He was really pissed. He goes, my son has two girlfriends that he's banging at the same time. But they watch the internet. These kids grow up fast.
Yeah, kids today have a totally different perception of what sex is.
But I think we were the same way. I was having sex at 15.
Yeah, it's not just that. You know, there was a study recently done that showed that more teens today are having anal sex than ever in the past.
Is that right?
Yeah, and what I thought immediately was, who the fuck is doing that study? Like, that's some guy's idea of a study. Like, what's he going to study? Earthquakes in California?
Yeah.
Possible superstorms? Like, no. How much are kids butt fucking today?
And by the way, who's financing that? Is that a government grant?
It was probably something like, you know, sex and diseases and things along those lines, because there's a lot of issues that go along with anal sex. You know, people watch movies and it seems like no big deal. Somebody puts in your butt, that's all well and good. But the reality is, you know, human papillomavirus and internal tears.
The flesh tearing activity.
That's what you called it? That's because she's a chick. It's called taking it in the bum.
It's not just for chicks, Joe. Be inclusive. It's for some guys.
Because she's a chick, dude. I didn't say it's just for chicks. How dare you?
Sorry.
What I said is she doesn't have a penis. That's what. You're on a big Camille Paglia kick, huh?
No, I took it when I was in school. I haven't read her for way more than a decade. But when I was in school, I took this class called Political Rhetoric. So we read like Martin Luther King, the stuff like that.
That was a really interesting point that you made about her last night. We were talking about like acquiring your food. There's a lot of things we don't do. We don't get rid of our own sewage. You know, that was a really good point.
Yeah, there's certain things like, you know, when I do interviews with people about wild game and hunting and that, you know, that like there are certain arguments that people come up with that would. And I love the arguments because they seem so sound, and I like to. But then when people bring them up, I always feel like I almost have to argue against myself for a minute. And one of the things would be people white-tailed deer meat. They're like, "Oh yeah, it's organic and everything." But like most white-tailed deer in farm country, a lot of wild game is organic. Like typically, like moose is absolutely going to be organic. Elk typically organic, but white-tailed deer live in farm country. I mean, these deer are fattened on Monsanto corn, you know?
Yeah, that's what we're talking
this
about.
This stuff is, like, treated with herbicides, pesticides, a lot of it's GMOs.
Yeah.
And they're out feeding on it. So it's like you can't be – like, I just try to always avoid bullshitting myself, right? So I always point out people like – I'm like, well, it's not – you know, if you're doing it – if you're hunting white-tailed deer in farm country because you want organic meat, it's like – you probably are actually looking for something different, and you're just trying to spin it to someone. Because
there's a big difference between this meat and, like, mule deer in Montana that are living in the breaks.
Yeah, mule deer in Montana, that would be, like, in many areas. And they might even visit a crop field down there, but they're not. It's not that they're, like, their only existence. The buck that Joe just got, that thing's stomach was packed full of shelled corn, you know. The other thing is this. It's easy to look at someone and say, like, okay, you eat meat, but you choose not to kill animals, therefore there's some level of hypocrisy there. But I always point out that's not really that rational, really, because we were saying last night, there's many, many activities that go into being alive and supporting oneself that we just opt out of, we choose not to participate in. I was pointing out the idea of, like, processing raw sewage. You know, every day you go into the bathroom and you flush it away and there it goes. And no one would ever, like, say, like, hey, I'm going to have my buddies out, and we're all going to process our raw sewage for the weekend in order to come away with a greater respect for what goes into treating sewage. Or we're all going to go and take all of our garbage and try to biodegrade our garbage. Or we're going to all fix cars all weekend. Or we're going to build our houses all weekend. Or we're going to make our clothes all weekend. Those things aren't enjoyable for most people. Hunting is very enjoyable. So I just try to point out that, like, if you eat meat and don't hunt, I don't think it's any different than if you shit in a toilet and don't treat raw sewage. You know what I mean? It's like everybody doesn't have to do this. And civilization is in some respects like this creation we have that allows us to specialize and allows us to partake in things we choose to partake in and to ignore things we choose to ignore. and it allows things like me, for instance, the luxury of being a writer. You know, I'm able to like farm out a ton of the activities that are necessary to keep me alive, focus on something that's not entirely pragmatic, like being a writer. And then the ones I do choose to go do, I can be selective about. And the one that means the most to me personally is I like to go hunt for my own food. I like to hunt for meat. And if it wasn't for meat, I wouldn't hunt, absolutely. But hunting is very fun and exciting, and it's a great way to learn things. It's all this stuff bundled up into a package. If you were to remove the meat aspect from it, I would quit. If you were to remove the fun aspect from it, I would quit. You know, I wouldn't go out there and, if I just hated it and was miserable, I wouldn't go out there and do it just because of the food issues, you know?
There's such a deep connection to people and their food. You know, I mean, people and their shit, you know, you could always dig a hole in the ground, just plop a dookie in there, and everything's going to be fine.
Yeah, which I've done hundreds of times out in the woods.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
That's what we did. We did it in Montana.
Oh, no, we had to use the special bags.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Wink, wink.
Joe's taking pictures and puts a – there's a deer, dead deer on the road. Joe's taking pictures of my poo, and I think I put a flag on it. No, you did. You fashioned a flag out of tinfoil, Joe.
Well, what I was going to do was give someone –
that's a muskrat hut. See that? See those mounds? Those are muskrat lodges.
We were going to put it on Twitter and give some $1,000 if they could find that flag. I was going to flag the poo and then have a contest.
Oh, I think people, I feel like, are naturally embarrassed. Like, no one, like, parades theirs around, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I was watching this movie about First Contact in Papua New Guinea. And the whites show up. I think they're Australians. Show up in the high country looking for gold. And at first, the indigenous peoples think that they're returning dead, that their corpses, like their ancestors, had come back with all these technologies and returned, and they had become godlike figures. And these gold miners said that after a while, the Papua New Guineans would follow them when they went off in the woods to take a shit. They'd follow them out there, and when they got done, they'd pick it up and smell it and toy with it. And eventually they're like, if these guys' shit stinks like our shit, they can't be something special. And it was like the turning moment. It was the turning moment. They realized, you're really nothing. You're nothing.
You know? That's so funny because you always hear that. Everybody, he acts like his shit don't stink, right?
Yeah, exactly.
At the end of the day, we all shit.
That's hilarious.
That's a great movie. It's called The Highland Trilogy. It's hard to find. A buddy of mine has it. The Highland Trilogy. It's like one's about First Contact, one's about guys trying to start coffee plantations, and the third one's sort of about a civil war breaks out among the tribes that work at the coffee plantation. And it's just like these guys are there. You're like watching actual footage of Highland tribes killing each other.
Wow.
At a coffee plantation. It's a great trilogy, man. The Highland Trilogy, yeah.
New Guinea's a freaky place,
oh,
man.
Oh, my God.
New Guinea.
You know what's weird? My 200 yards off this highway in Montana.
That's a lot.
The whole time you were talking about Papua New Guinea, I was thinking about sitting there waiting for deer and telling shit stories and laughing our ass off. Like a grown men, me and Joe exchanging shit stories and laughing, laughing hysterically. I mean, you know, that's not exactly hunting etiquette. You're supposed to be quiet and wait. And we're like,
well, we were in a unusual situation. It wasn't just hunting. It was a lot of us. The odds of us actually shooting a deer during the next 30 minutes were kind of slim, and we were having a good time.
You know, like an old hunting trick. My brother, he calls it taking a heater because – if it's really cold for whatever reason, if you're like shivering, it's really cold, and he goes off and takes a growler, he always feels a little warmer out in the woods. It's like, you know how eating makes you cold? Yeah. Taking a heater.
Taking a
just like for whatever reason, it causes like a spike in your internal body temperature.
Really?
I feel that that's true too. Because you're thinking like it's going to be so miserable, right? Exposing myself, you know, in the cold. And in the end, you come away feeling a little.
Wow, I didn't experience that when we were in Montana.
Oh, you didn't?
The first night when it was pouring rain and I had to step outside the tent to take a shit. Oh, that was brutal. Oh,
that sucked. And, hey, thanks a lot for telling us about foot warmers and body warmers, dude. freezing my ass off for five straight days. How about giving your novice hunters a couple of pointers? We just show up, man. You gave us zero instruction. I was just told to bring warm stuff and the first hunting trip. You got a couple of first timers, man. How about giving us a couple of tricks? Like, I don't know, fill my hot water bottle and put it at the end bottom of my sleeping bag so I didn't freeze for 3 days. That blew.
Well, you know what? I'm going to use this for shameless some in a year. Our guide, we have a hunting guidebook coming out, and the hunting guidebook has extensive information about how not to freeze your ass off.
Really?
Oh yeah. Cold from years of experience.
He had a lot of stuff going on, though, man. I mean, you think about it. You've got a production team. You got cameras. You got to telling people what.
It's true. I like that when I was asking you about all the, you know, like what a grizzly bear attacks and you guys got charged by a grizzly and asking about animals and how you protect yourself against animals. And you were like, the way people get messed up when you're hunting is falling or the cold, basically getting wet and dying of hypothermia because the temperature drops to 45.
Much more common.
Yeah, little things. And what was that? What was that parasite you got?
Yeah, I've been in the hot, like all the time. When I go hunting, you're always thinking of, like, cool things, cool bad things happening to you. You're going to get mauled by a bear, a lion's going to get you, an avalanche is going to get you. The two times I've been in the hospital, one has been, they've both been from Mike parasites, bacterial stuff. I got infected a couple times with a protozoa called Giardia. I think it's a protozoa.
How do they get rid of that?
Oh, you treat it with some kind of, oral antibiotic that kills it. And I've had that a couple times. Got that in Michigan, got in Arizona, got it in Colorado.
What happens to you?
It's just from being stupid about drinking water. See those Canada geese up there? All V'd out. Then I got Lyme disease, which is a bacterial infection carried by ticks, which burrow into your... And that, it's just the little shit is getting you. The little dinky things get you, and you're paying attention to the big things. Hunting in BC and in one trip got charged by a grizzly bear, but it was a bluff charge and she spun at the and I got charged by a wounded moose that got up and actually knocked me over like a bullfighter, knocked me over with his antlers onto the ground, and then I scurried away and my buddy hit him in the head.
You got really lucky in that one, huh?
Real super lucky, man. And I kept reaching back and I would rub the back of my rain gear and my hand kept coming back all bloody, and I thought he punctured my ass with his antler. But it was just his blood from the front of him.
When you couldn't
when he
feel,
ran me over, his blood got all over me.
Was it because of the adrenaline? You couldn't feel if you were injured or not?
No, I could feel that I got poked in the ass, but it just didn't puncture it.
Poked in the ass by a moose. God damn. How big was it?
Oh, I mean, they're heavy, heavy animals. You know, I mean, you get a bull, the bull moose be up to 1,000 pounds. But, you know, like bulls like that, 700-800 pounds. You can't even move them. You can't roll them over. A person, one guy. When you get him on the ground, you got to just start butchering it however it's laying. You're not going to, you're not able to, like, manipulate the carcass at all. You just got to start working, getting weighed out.
Sometimes they fall, like, in a marsh, too, right?
Yeah, that can be really bad. Because you're not going to get it out, you know, unless you got a whole team of guys, you know.
Wow.
So I've never had that happen. I've got friends that have had that happen where they land in the water. But people take, they'll go. One time, Danny was telling me that they watched the moose for several days, waiting for the moose to get close enough to the water where they could get a boat by it, but then have it be not so close to the water that it might go into the water and die in the water. I mean, you really got to plan ahead on how you're going to handle those things. They're huge.
They're so big. I'd never seen one in person until this past summer. We saw five of them in a couple of days.
Well, I thought was wild is that you shot it in the brisket, in the chest, with a 270 or
300 Win Mag.
300 Win Mag, and the thing, and I guess it didn't hit anything vital, or maybe it did, but the thing just kept coming, right?
Yeah, that was a stupid move. And we were filming my show when it's happened, and I kind of made a big point on camera to explain, like, look at all this waterfowl, man. I made a big point on camera to explain that was a really stupid move. I'll never do it again. Like a frontal shot, like a brisket shot, if you're close and your bullet placement's going to be right because you're close enough to do it right, is very effective on deer size. A moose is just too big. There's too much bone and muscle. And it's not a humane. I regret doing it. I probably could have told you ahead of time. I probably could have said, like, yeah, that's dumb to do. But oftentimes, hunting brings on these snap decisions you're making, like snap decisions. There are shots you should not have taken but did, and there's shots you maybe could have taken and didn't, and the latter is better. You know, it's better to be like, yeah, I should not do this and wait for a better opportunity. But I got, you know, got greedy.
Is that the closest you came to danger on your show?
With it. Yeah, close, because it actually touched, you know. Yeah, definitely, for sure, yeah.
Wow.
And yeah, I should have done it. It was a stupid shot taken. It wasn't fair to the moose, you know. So we had to wound up finishing him off. And then the other big mistake I made is I ran after it. But at the other hand, if you don't run after it, if he doesn't leave a good blood trail, you might not find him. So I was like kind of between a rock and a hard place. You know, you shouldn't chase the thing off through the swamp. But then if you don't chase it, what if he gets away and you can't recover him? So I chased after him, and sure enough, he wound up getting the jump on me and spun around and knocked me down.
Wow.
People get killed by a water buffalo that way all the time when they hunt a water buffalo.
Cape buffalo.
Yeah, the Cape buffalo, what they do is they'll shoot it. A lot of times it'll run into the tall grass, and you have to go in there and get it. And they wait for you in the tall grass, and when they're wounded, the minute they see you in that grass, they're charging.
Oh, those things are badasses too, man. I've never hunted them. I never, you know, but they're badass. Check out all these geese.
A lot of geese are flying through the air right now. Steve's thinking about pulling out a shotgun.
Yeah, it's so funny how Steve's mind works, right? Like he's like, there's a squirrel, waterfowl.
He got so fired up just seeing pigeons. Like, oh, pigeons. Yeah, what'd you do with those pigeons? You going to bring them back to your house?
I left them for Doug. You know, I brought everything else. I got my extra beaver meat and everything, but I left the pigeons there. I just ran out of time to skin them.
I was surprised at how good that beaver was.
I got to say, yeah, I was going to say the exact same thing. Beaver is pretty delicious.
Unbelievable.
I'm shocked that more people don't eat it.
Yeah, but it's like you got to harvest it under fur harvester, you know. It's like right. It's not you can't hunt. In most places you can't hunt for them. But people do. A lot of indigenous people eat it, you know.
It's such a weird animal though. The look of it when you had that thing skinned and you were butchering it, I was like, that is the weirdest looking thing ever. It looks like it's alien.
What I like about, I mean, I get a couple a year, you know. I'll trap a couple a year, and what I like them for is I like to cook the meat. It's fun to cook the meat. People always appreciate it because they're always real surprised by it, so it's fun to do that. I like to do the tail, to cook the tail to get the fat out, which is a thing that mountain men and fur trappers and the, you know, guys that explored the Rocky Mountains, it was like a big thing for them to eat beaver tail. They liked it. And I also like to then get the fur and turn that into stuff like hats, mittens, you know, throw pillows with scarves. I mean, various things. So I'll get a couple a year and do stuff like that with it. And like I have a fur hat that I had made with fur I trapped. And
do you wear it?
Oh yeah, it's just like a bomber. It's just like your hat, man, but the fur is my own fur.
Do you wear that when you go out in New York City?
No, I wear it ice fishing.
It's crazy. It's
wears it to work. She like kind of almost stole that hat. That's why I'm gonna probably take one of these new beavers and get her a hat made, because she always takes my hat to work.
Where does one get a hat made out of beaver?
I go with this. I don't know if I want to say his name. There's a lot of guys. What's that?
You don't have to say his name. It's cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of. If you type in like custom fur hats, you'll find people.
Like
I know a great guy, and I would happily tell anybody a great guy, but I don't want to tell and then have it be that. Right. Oh, here's this trapper, and here's his name.
Right.
Because he's
right.
A trapper, but he also what he does. He's a fur trapper, but rather than selling fur into the markets, than selling fur into the commercial markets in Canada where buyers from Russia and China all coming by. He's a trapper, but he takes his furs and makes goods, makes items, blankets, pillows, hats, mittens, all this kind of stuff, and just sells them directly himself.
Trapping seems to be even more contentious and controversial than hunting.
It's hugely controversial. Colorado, when I was trapping a lot, I started trapping when I was 10. I caught my first muskrat when I was 10 in 1984. And I didn't quit trapping until I was 22 years old. And I trapped hardcore. Muskrat, mink, beaver, raccoon, red fox, otter, coyote. I trapped everything. And during that time was when PETA was really coming into play. And they really did a great job. They did a great job marketing against trapping. And, like, Colorado even had an all-out trap ban. You know, because Colorado, you know, the whole, like, it's still pointed out, like, the red state, blue state thing. You have Colorado, where you have a rural state, but you have Fort Collins, and you have Denver. And it's so evenly split between rural and urban that the urban people, who really don't have a lot of experience with these animals anyways, don't have any access to them, don't really know anything about them, were able to shut down fur trapping in an entire state. And you can't get that law reversed. In the end, it actually worked against wildlife, because now on private land, all that wildlife goes under damage control. And you can basically go in there and raise holy hell on fur-bearing animals when they get to problem levels in a way that is destructive, can be destructive, certainly leads to a lot of waste, rather than having people go out and trap it and market the furs. So it's super contentious, and there's a lot of... Someone recently contacted me to see if I would help support them on a bill to ban fur trapping on public land. And they're like, oh, it's all hunters that are behind us. I'm like, no, it's not. No, it's not. You're trying to dress it up as something it's not.
The whole trapping thing is just... It's very weird. You know, you're killing an animal and just taking its skin and making things.
If you don't eat it, for sure.
Yeah.
I didn't. When I was trapping, I would use most of the carcass, you know, or I'd sell them to sled dog racers. Because sled dog racers would want the muskrats and the beaver. They'd gut them and run it through a grinder. And these guys were like, they would say during a race, they like to feed their dogs beaver and muskrat. They said it was the best feed for during a race.
Why is that?
I don't know. They just thought it was a real rich food.
Because it's so fatty?
Yeah, when you're trying to raise a bunch of sled dogs, it's hugely expensive. So if someone has a horse that dies, whatever, sled dog racers, they'd go out and get that meat, boil it in big vats, and feed it to their dogs, because it's a real expense, and a lot of sled wealthy people, you know? So yeah. I would sell the carcass. I could get, like, I would sell muskrat carcasses for $1 or $2 a piece. I'd sell beaver carcasses for $3, sometimes $5 a piece to dog racers, and it'd go for dog food.
That's interesting.
And I'd sell the hides into the markets.
There's a show one of the shows that I watch. I think it's called the Yukon Men. That's what it's called. And these people live up north in Alaska, and they have to catch fish for their dogs. They need like several hundred pounds of fish every year. So they take a lot of the salmon that they catch is just for dogs. They
even call it dog salmon.
Yeah,
chum salmon. They call it dog salmon.
They take this stuff and they boil it in these big vats and slop it out to their dogs. And they were talking about how if it wasn't for the salmon, like, they wouldn't be able to keep dogs.
I was watching this Herzog movie about fur trappers in Siberia, and those guys feed their dogs a lot of northern pike.
Oh, the happy people, life
in the taiga.
Yeah,
that's a great movie, man.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. Herzog's one of the best. He makes some pretty bad movies, but he makes some of the best movies, too. Like Fitzcarraldo and...
Jack Reacher.
Didn't he do Grizzly Man? He did Grizzly Man.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did that movie with Tom Cruise. Yes, he did. He was in it. He was one of the actors.
He made it?
No, he was one of the actors.
He was in it. Oh, I'll believe that.
It was hilarious, because to see him in that, knowing him from Grizzly Man.
You know, the thing, Grizzly Man, like, I get asked about that stuff a lot, like dudes like Grizzly Man. And there's a thing, like, people in Alaska... They have this, I shouldn't say people, many people in Alaska have this knee-jerk thing where they always want to act like anyone who comes up to Alaska, especially someone that meets bad ends, had it come in and they were so stupid. Grizzly Man, anyone who thinks like, oh, he should have known this and should have done that and he's so stupid, that dude would out-camp anyone. To spend all those years camping in one of the most miserable camping locations, to camp down in an alder swamp, 13 summers or 7 summers in a row, all summer, in the rain, in the insects, that guy was the ultimate badass camper. He would out-camp anyone.
He was a hard camper, you say.
Super hard camper. And he said, I'll wind up getting killed by a bear, probably.
I think he wanted to do it. Yeah, I think it was like, suicide by bear.
I wouldn't have wanted to hang out with that guy. And there's a lot about that guy that annoys me. And we have way different perspectives on hunting. But... as far as being a person who can endure, and being a good woodsman often comes down to being a good, you know, having good endurance. He's an admirable figure for physical endurance. Or he's just so crazy he can't tell he's suffering. I don't know.
Yeah, he was just nuts. I think that guy was running from his reality in a lot of ways.
But he found a new reality.
Yeah, getting eaten.
Yeah, that was pretty brutal. I guess there is a tape of it and stuff. He and his girl.
There's an audio recording.
Yeah, hit him with a pan. Hit him with a pan, man. Jesus.
That bear.
That bear's not hearing a peep out of your pan.
No.
I mean,
you imagine trying to kill a bear with a frying pan.
Well, you and I have both choked out. I don't know if you, but I've choked my pit bull off my other pit bull. Like when she grabbed hold of. Yeah, I used to have two pits, and I used to like them. They're a pain in the ass, but they're really sweet dogs, and I like their physicality. They're so tough, but they're terriers. They're
very
just great.
Smart.
All your kids.
Hell no. No.
They're very smart.
But the thing about pits is I remember choking my female off, my other female. I put her in a rear naked choke, and the power in that dog, you know.
Yeah, they're very muscular.
And you think about, that's a 45-pound dog. You think about an 800-pound grizzly or something. I mean, it's just a whole different level of.
Absolutely huge grizzly, 800 pounds. Is it? 500, 600 pounds is plenty, man.
What's the biggest grizzlies get? Like, you know, a giant fucking male.
You hear, like, again, there's these figures that get thrown around, and people throw the figures around more than is warranted by. But there's kind of 1,000 people say, like, 1,000-pound grizzly. And there's a lot more people talking about 1,000-pound grizzlies than there are than actually exist. But that number can be achieved, 1,000-pound grizzly. But there are a few. Like, same way, people, like, talk about 200-pound mountain lions, you know. A big lion, like a lion gets up to 150 pounds, he's becoming a very big lion.
You said that they'd weighed, you talked to somebody who tagged and weighed 346 mountain lions, and the biggest they found was 147 pounds, right?
Yeah, somewhere in there. It was like, and then he knew a guy that had one, he knew another biologist that hit one at 164 or something, but everybody's always talking. Like, everybody that sees a mountain lion, it's always a big Tom. We'll spend 200-pound Tom. And I like, one thing I like about Joe Rogan is Joe Rogan says he saw a mountain lion. And rather than saying it was a huge Tom, probably 200 pounds, he admits it was, what, 70 pounds?
Yeah, it was about 70 pounds. It was terrifying, though.
Still a big animal.
Realistic. It's a big, long, lanky cat when you see it.
I've seen two of them, and they were both about that size. The second one was about the size of a coyote. I saw it actually in Santa Barbara.
I was driving
through Montecito, and I thought I saw a coyote run across the road, but then I saw its tail, and then I realized, oh, shit, that's a cat. God damn. And it couldn't have been no bigger than, you know, a regular-sized coyote.
I've seen three in the wild, and I cherish those three sightings, you know. It's just when you see a mountain lion, it's impossible to think about anything else for at least a couple hours, I've found.
Wow.
And I could tell you every detail about leading up to and after seeing those lions. It's like very special moments. But I got a friend who hunts a lot of coos deer in Arizona and Mexico. And hunting coos deer, you just spend a ton of time behind glass. You spend a ton of time looking through binoculars. And I was one day, I said to him, his name's Jay. I said, hey, man, how many mountain lions? I said, I've seen three lions. I said, how many mountain lions you seen in the wild? He said, right now I'm looking for number 33.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
33.
Number 33. Because he just glasses. He glasses those.
That's not running with dogs. That's just looking through his binoculars for coos deer. He's found 30.
Are there
he's
more
found
in Mexico?
32 lions.
Is that what it is?
There's good lions in Mexico. But one of the things you get into, like in Arizona and in this area of Mexico, is there's very good visibility. And you can see a lot, you know. You could have 100 freaking lions within 100 yards of us right now. You ain't going to see one of them.
You tell me they found there was some guys that got a jaguar in Mexico as well. They saw that.
Yep. Every year people – plus, man, guys that run lions in Arizona with hounds will quite often have to pull their dogs off a track because they realize it's a jaguar.
Really?
The way they say it'll go is this. You'll be out and you'll be running what you think is a huge mountain lion. So you got a big track. You're like, man, this is an unusually large mountain lion. But jags don't like to go up trees, and lions will go up trees when they're getting run. So they'll be on a track, and they'll see that this thing just won't tree. He'll keep skirmishing the dogs, but he'll never go into a tree. And eventually they'll be like, man, we're running a jag. And then they got to collect their dogs and pull their dogs off. If they do get the jag up in a rock pile, then you got to get all the dogs collected, and the last thing the dogs want to do is leave, you know, and it turns into a big fight. But yeah, they'll was not like on an every year level, but you gather, if you're a lifelong lion hunter, that you're gonna in Arizona and in southern Arizona, you're gonna have times when you realize you're on a jag track.
Do they have a good consensus of what the population is?
If you look at a range and distribution map, a conservative range in distribution that's contemporary, not historic, but we'll show them not in Arizona.
Not.
You're talking about Jaguars.
Yeah.
Jags. You'd show them not there because the general view on it is that you're getting some animals coming across the border, and there's not a stable breeding population of them.
So it's
probably
just a rare
males,
aberration.
Like you're probably getting males drifting up in the area. So like a conservative range and distribution map will show them as having been present in historic times and not present now.
That's fascinating.
And it's a hope that they, you know, everybody hopes that they do get a foothold and come in. But I shouldn't even say the word jag because it makes me sound like I'm more of an expert in them than I am. I've never seen one in the wild. Jaguars have a way of getting in trouble with livestock, even more than mountain lions.
Even people too, right? I mean, they're pretty dangerous for people, or
no, they're just not. I mean, they're just not. I mean, you hear about it, but it's like it's sensational. It gets people's attention, you know.
Well, they have problems with them in the Amazon, right?
Yeah, it'll happen, but it doesn't happen as much as it's like.
They're just not around people that much.
Yeah, they're not around people that much. But when it does happen, it gets people's attention, you know. Like if right now, if tomorrow a guy in Florida gets killed by an alligator, you're going to hear all about it. You're not going to hear about all the guys that get killed by cars tomorrow in Florida.
Right, that's a good point.
What about like, mountain lions are so elusive. Where are they hiding? Like, why are they so difficult? They see you coming, obviously, and they're really good at being elusive. But do they live in caves? Is that what they do? Do they live in rocks?
Yeah, I think there's a handful of things. They do a lot of ambush hunting, so they spend a lot of time just laying. They like to hunt at night, so they're not out and about so much in the daytime. I mean, there's exceptions to all this, of course. Like you'll see, the lions I've seen have all been in the daytime. I haven't seen a lion ambush hunting. I've just seen them traveling. But they do spend a lot of time ambush hunting. They spend a lot of time laying low during the daytime. And they're, you know, we use the term secretive, but they're kind of a shy animal. They're not, you know, they don't typically go and do a lot of loud, audacious activities, and they don't stand out in cut cornfields like deer do. And they don't travel as much as coyotes, you know, throughout, like, just the middle of the day running around. And there's fewer of them. You know, there's not a lot of them. There are plenty of them in a lot of places, and they're expanding. Agencies in the eastern U.S. are having to more and more come to terms with the fact that there are lions drifting into these areas. There's because lions are indigenous all over the U.S., the mountain lion, at a time, was the most widely distributed animal. The most widely distributed animal in the Western Hemisphere. Now they're largely absent from you know, most of the United States, but they're coming back. And because they were here and because they were extirpated by human activities, there's all kinds of ramifications of that. Like you could potentially, if you had a naturally occurring breeding population, you'd have to come to terms with the fact that they might be eligible for the Endangered Species Act all across the eastern U.S., which would have huge implications for development, logging, other activities. So even though now lions will get hit by cars in weird places where they supposedly don't live, there's a lot of resistance on the part of wildlife managers to say, yes, we have a breeding viable population of lions in states like Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Kentucky.
You see that one that they found in Connecticut last year?
Yeah.
How fucking nuts is that?
And when you look at a range and distribution map of the mountain lion, no one's shading in Connecticut yet.
Yeah, it's nuts. That cat apparently originated in the Dakotas.
Yep. The males will really get up and go. You know, they'll turn up weird places. But they one time tagged a wolf in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. A guy killed it in Missouri. That thing crossed the Mississippi River. Innumerable highway corridors. A guy was coming back from bow hunting and sees a coyote trying to raid his chicken coop and shoots it with a bow, walks up to it, and he's like, uh-oh. Calls in. He killed a wolf that had been tagged up in the Upper Peninsula. And the last thing on his mind is a wolf running around in Missouri.
Wow.
You know?
A wolf that was trying to raid his chicken coop.
Why?
Come out of Montana, I think, turn up in Missouri one time.
Why would you, if you put a mountain lion on an Endangered Species Act, you said it would have huge implications because all of a sudden if there is a stable breeding population in a state that didn't have it, now you've got to designate habitat that could have been for development?
Yeah, whenever you do an environmental impact statement, it has to be like, how is it going to affect this? In addition to other concerns, it'd be, well, how is it going to affect our endangered mountain lion population? So if you like one of the things that happens, like when it comes to wildlife in a historic sense, is you have to, if you can point out that a species is in trouble because of human activities, right? Like if we clone mammoths and bring mammoths, aren't going to be eligible for the Endangered Species Act, because while some people think that the mammoth went extinct due to human hunting in the Pleistocene-Holocene transition, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the mammoth just went extinct for climatic reasons, or, you know, other things. Meteor collision, climatic reasons, there's all these explanations for it. So it wouldn't be like you'd clone a mammoth and bring it back and then give them endangered species protection, right? Because we don't know that it was human causes. We don't know that it was human causes that led to their depletion and eventual extinction. We know that lions were shot out, and, you know, poison's real effective on them.
That's interesting.
They're shot out and poisoned out. And now, if they were to come back on their own, like not through an introduction, not through a reintroduction, but they're just to come back by drifting in from Canada, drifting in from the American West, someone is eventually going to put forth a lawsuit saying that these things deserve endangered species protection.
It's really interesting. Like, an animal has to be going extinct because of humans for it to be on the Endangered Species Act. It's not just going
extinct. I don't know how that's phrased or how that's enforced, but those are the ones that are, those are the ones that get it, you know. And I don't know how it's phrased or how it's done, but there's a big difference when it comes to doing like something like this. You've heard the terms like reintroduction and introduction.
Yeah.
The reason they were able to bring wolves, when they put wolves back in the greater Yellowstone region, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, when they brought wolves back in Yellowstone, they were able to do it because they were able to call it a reintroduction, and they were able to prove that wolves had been extirpated by human causes. So you're able to do a reintroduction. You would never be able to, you're never going to get the okay to take like a large predator and introduce it in a place where it never existed.
What do you think about
that? You're not
going
to overcome the political resistance.
Reintroduction of wolves is very controversial, isn't it? Because they're decimating deer and elk
hugely
populations.
Controversial, because in my opinion, I support the reintroduction, and I support maintaining stable populations of wolves, and I even support bringing them into areas where they've been regionally extirpated and bringing back populations of them. But I think you need to keep tight grip on them. I think you need to treat them like a renewable resource, and allow harvest in order to keep the population at a level where we can still maintain game populations. I'm interested in maintaining game populations because I'm a hunter, and I try to do things to defend the culture of hunting and to defend public access to renewable wildlife resources. I think wolves should be treated the same way. When they brought wolves in, I don't think it was ever many people's intentions was to not go so far beyond recovery levels before they started hunting them. You know, they had some benchmarks where they're like, we'll consider wolves recovered when they achieve these certain population numbers, distribution. And they let it go way beyond, to the effect where it's having dramatic effects on elk and moose populations and other wild game populations. Caught a lot of issues with livestock. And by letting it go so far, and letting them become so abundant before you initiated some harvest, they really allowed for a radical polarization in people, where a lot of people now that might have been tolerant to the presence of wolves have just thrown their hands up in the air, and they're sick of them, and they want them gone.
Because they're so effective at being at taking out livestock and game. I mean, they're really effective killers because they're so...
The game's not used to it. The game lost... The game... Elk, moose lost their ability to cope with it. At a time, they could cope quite well. Alaska, wolves occupy like 95% of their historic range in Alaska. They're not as able to just devastate wildlife populations there because the wildlife has evolved with it and lives with it and knows how to cope. Take the Yellowstone National. Anybody who's ever been to Yellowstone National Park knows you can drive around Yellowstone National Park and walk right up to elk, okay? Walk right up to deer. Walk right up to bears. They don't care because they've been living now for 100 years in the absence of human predation, okay? When they think about the things they need to worry about, humans are not on that list. If all of a sudden tomorrow you were able to say, like, you know what? We're going to start hunting Yellowstone National Park. It would take a while for the elk there to readjust and learn how to cope with humans the way that the elk who are 20 miles in any direction know how to do. Elk in the Madison Range outside of the park are frustratingly phenomenal at evading human predators. In time, I think, than people think. In time, these animals are going to learn, don't hang out in the big valleys. Like, they're going to learn, like, how to stay away from elk, how to position yourself where you can smell, or I'm sorry, how to stay away from wolves, how to evade wolves, what to do when wolves are around. Right now, they stand there and they look at it and be like, man, that's a big dog. And the next thing you know is trouble. So they'll pick it up, you know. The same way I think when we look at how mountain lions are making such a comeback, bears are making a comeback, I think the animals are just having a slow adjustment and being like, here's how you deal with people. White-tailed deer were very quick to figure it out. Other things, it's taken them a long time to figure out. And the fact that we can now have lions in our presence and not really even know they're there till they get hit by a car suggests that they're in some way making some adjustments and going like, here's what you do to get by around people. You watch out for them.
It was amazing to see the difference between the way deer behaved on opening day and then on the second day. Like,
huge
a real
difference,
quick.
Man. They know. Because there's a lot of does out there. You got deer out there that are 5, 6, 7 years old and older. The females. It's not unreasonable. I mean, you'll turn up females that are 13, 14, 15 years old.
Wow.
She's been through that many hunting seasons. She's like, something seems a little fishy, something seems a little weird, a lot of activity in the woods, people putting stuff out in the woods. I remember this from before. And then opening morning, blam, blam, blam is all she needs to hear, and she goes into mode.
She's been there, done that.
Yep. She goes in, she gets down a hillside where she can survey the hill below her. She's got wind coming from the behind her. She can smell what's behind her. She backs up against the log, and she's going to stay put until you...
The sound of the gunfire is unusual. That was really interesting on opening day.
Yeah, it's a lot.
You see her, boom.
You got a state like this, I think you got some 600,000 hunters.
600,000 hunters.
That's a lot of license money, man. It's a lot of wildlife money.
That's crazy, man. It's a 9-day season. That is a crazy number. I couldn't. If you had told me that number before I heard it, I never would.
I could be wrong. I think that's right, but I mean, I don't want. If someone knows better,
shit. Even if it's half,
send these guys a text message.
If it's half of that, 300. It's a lot of fucking hunters.
And that's license. That's how many guys bought licenses. So whether they hunt for an hour, they hunt all 9 days, but it's a pile of hunters.
It seems like with livestock, if you live in mountain lion country or wolf country, I guess a fence doesn't necessarily work with a mountain lion, right? I mean,
they climb right over them.
They grease right under them, grease over them.
Grease under them and grease over them.
I love the word Steve uses.
Critters.
Yeah,
shooting critters, iron.
Yeah.
Grease.
He's like, I had a circle on my abdomen. I usually say stomach, but you say abdomen. What'd you call?
Rabbits.
Rabbits is so funny.
Oh, there's rabbits and hares are different. Like one, like a hare is what they call precocial, where he's ready to rock, like out of the box. He's born from his mom and can hop around. Cottontails are not. Cottontails need to be nursed in a nest. But together you have lagomorphs. Hares and rabbits. Yeah.
Lagomorphs. Yeah, he's not a lagomorph. I was like.
It sounds like something from Harry Potter.
Yeah, it does.
It's like one of the main professors.
That's exactly what it is.
One of the guys who teaches you how to use magic. Yep. Lagomorph.
I think we're close to the airport, so we may have to.
Yeah, we're getting pretty close.
But
11 miles away.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a great trip, Steve. We had a great time, man. It was really a lot of fun.
Amazing.
You know, I really love having you guys out. You know, the guys we were hunting with, they were telling me that their faces were actually in pain from how much they laughed, which is nice.
Yeah,
that's what we
do.
That's our job.
Yeah, you know, it's harder to be funny than it is to hunt. So it's good to have you guys out.
Well, you know, speaking of funny, I got good news for everybody.
If you're
in Salt Lake City.
Oh, you son of a bitch.
In Salt Lake City, November 29th and 30th, I'll be at Wise Guys. Then I'll be at Helium in December.
You can't give them too many days to get confused. It becomes ineffective.
I love it. I'm like, Joe, I have Joe tweet for me, which actually has a huge, makes a big impact. You're like my one man promotion machine.
I'm your publicist.
He's my publicist. I'll be like, Joe, I'm doing stand up. Can you please tweet? I was asking him that shit before I even knew how to tweet. Remember, I was like, I don't know. I tweeted. I think.
Well, he would say, can you tweet this for me? And I was like, dude, you got to tweet it for yourself too.
Or how about I'd post a link that didn't work.
Yeah.
Post a link. I was like, you got to leave a link so people can buy tickets. I was like, oh, okay.
Well, you were just a little scattered, and you weren't taking it that serious. You got to take your. You know, the social networking is very important.
Yeah.
But you're much better at it now. And it's not just that. You can't just tweet links because then people don't want to give. You know, they want they want it to be entertaining. They want you to put out stuff that they enjoy.
Yeah. Now I try to just be funny.
Yeah,
I resisted Twitter. I don't know why. You know, you just get stuff in your head and you're making a point. I was like, I'll never send a tweet in my life. And my buddy Ben said, oh, I bet you. We settled on a bet. I think it was $8. And I had to pay him the $8 like 3 days later. It was that the transformation was that fast. Oh, man. Like when Twitter broke. I'm like, nah. 140 characters. I'm a verbose man, you know.
Look at that deer. We got a deer right there.
Oh, yeah.
We're driving. We're driving to the airport, and that deer is all curled up in the back of his Jeep.
A hitch carrier.
Called a hitch carrier. Yeah. Okay. I just call it a carrier, but you call it a hitch carrier. All right. Well, I guess Joe, do you have any last words for us?
Go see Brian in Salt Lake City.
Come on, Joe. That's shameless self-promotion, man.
I want to say this. Joe Rogan's first whitetail buck, he door nailed it, dropped right in his tracks.
Yeah, that was it didn't go anywhere.
No.
Yeah, Joe. Yeah, Joe. What cracks me up about Joe is that now that Joe's into hunting, you just watch. You just watch. He doesn't like to rely on anybody. He'll be a crack shot. He will be practicing his rifle. I will be calling him, and he'll be like, "Nah, I'm going to the range. You want to come?" And he'll squeeze off. You know, be like, "Well, don't work on a rifle because if you shoot more than 20, you start to shy." Not Joe Rogan. I promise you, he'll squeeze off 400 rounds in a day. His finger will be all messed up. His ears will hurt from those earmuffs. Because he's an extremist, but he will become. He'll be a crack shot.
Huh? What?
No, I wear big earmuffs, man. Oh, yeah, I don't.
You know what? You should, because I got a lot of ear, not a lot, but my left ear.
You're
gonna
take a right at 151. Did you miss it? Yes, Madison. Fuck.
No, not really.
Yeah,
no, we got
that's the exit we needed to take. 135.
All right, guys, we're gonna cut this off.
We're gonna have to pay attention to what the fuck we're doing here, folks.
See you, folks. Thank you.
See ya.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.